Greetings and glurglomatic Ratio Nations, my lentative listeners, and welcome to this October 2019 Science News Update. I'm your host for this distractedly retentive podcast segment, Jim Campanella. Let's start the evening with Insane Historical Scientist of the Month. I may as well go with crazy people who are dead when it's hard to find new idiots that are alive. I should probably be grateful for that. Anyway, University of Madrid graduate Dr. Jose Delgado may have received a prestigious professorship at Yale University, but his research at the venerable institution's physiology department was, well, let's say strange, because on a whole, it dealt with mind control. And you're thinking, Dr. Camp, you're kidding, right? Yeah, sure, mind control at Yale? Oh, no, ladies and germs, I am not joking. Definitely. Delgado was a genuine psycho. While at Yale in the 50s and 60s, Delgado inserted electrode implants into the brains of primates and used a remote control that gave off radio frequencies to make the animals perform complex actions. He called this thing a stimosiever. The most famous example of the stimosiever in action occurred at a Cordoba bull breeding ranch in España. Delgado stepped into the ring with a bull which had had a stimosiever implanted into its brain. The bull charged Delgado, who pressed a remote control button that caused the bull to stop its charge. Apparently, one for theatrics, he taped this whole stunt, and believe it or not, you can still see it today on YouTube. Go ahead, look it up if you're curious. Delgado and the Charging Bull, or look up Stimo Receiver and Delgado, and you will find this video. The region of the brain Delgado stimulated when he pressed the handheld transmitter was the caudate nucleus, and that region was chosen to be stimulated because the caudate nucleus is involved in controlling voluntary movements. Delgado claimed that the stimulus caused the bull to lose its aggressive instinct. Although the bull incident was widely mentioned in the popular media, Delgado believed that his most important experiment was with a female chimpanzee named Patty. Patty was fit with a stimosiever linked to a computer that detected the brain signal called a spindle, which was emitted by part of her brain called the amygdala. When the spindle was received, the stimosiever sent a signal to Patty's brain, producing an aversive reaction, quote-unquote. In this case, the aversive reaction was an unpleasant or painful feeling. The result of the aversive reaction to the stimulus was a negative feedback to the brain. So within hours, her brain was producing fewer of these spindle signals as a result of the negative feedback. As a result, Patty became, quote, quieter, less attentive, and less motivated during behavioral testing, unquote. Delgado hypothesized that the method used on Patty could be used on others to stop panic attacks, seizures, and other disorders controlled by certain signals in the brain. Now, anybody else would have stopped right there with animals, but no, not Delgado. He went to a private research hospital, and he convinced them to agree to let him try out a stimosiever on hopeless neural patients upon whom no treatment had previously worked. Delgado wired up no less than 25 people to see if he could stop seizures and panic attacks. Behaviorally, his device only impacted people's aggression, but he kept striving for a way to achieve mind control. The novel in the movie Terminal Man by Michael Crichton is based on some of Delgado's seriously weird-ass work. Was Delgado obsessed with mind control? Oh yeah, baby. He's famous for saying this. You'll love it. Quote, "We must electronically control the brain. Someday, armies and generals will be controlled by electric stimulation directly to the brain." Unquote. I think we have a winner here for the most cracked, folks. Okay. Since we have been talking about mind-controlling bulls, I think the next story actually fits into that similar category of weirdness. Having to do with bulls, that is. So, newly born bulls, not horny. Wait, that didn't sound right. Here, let me try that again. Genetically engineered bulls have no horns. Makes more sense, I guess. So 3 years ago, a genome edit was made in two male dairy bulls to introduce a hornless phenotype. Dr. Allison Van Einenum and researchers from the University of California, Davis, knocked out a gene called POLD that is needed for horns to develop. A new study published 2 weeks ago in the journal Nature Biotechnology by Van Einenum and company has investigated whether the POLD genome edit was faithfully passed on to offspring of those mutated bulls. By crossing one genome-edited dairy bull with two copies of the dominant mutant POLD allele with horned cows, the group was able to obtain six heterozygote calves that were born with just a single copy of the mutant allele. Now, if you remember your basic Mendelian genetics, you only need one copy of a dominant gene to see the trait. So the result was that the calves were born without horns and were otherwise healthy and phenotypically unremarkable. These calves are the first reported offspring of a genome-edited bull. Von Einenum reports that blood work and physical exams of the calves found that they were all healthy. The researchers also conducted whole genome sequencing of all animals using a next-generation high-speed sequencing system to achieve a 20-fold coverage of each genome, and they analyzed these genomic sequences looking for any unexpected changes. Why bother with all this nonsense? I mean, think about it. Does it really matter whether a dairy bull has horns or doesn't have horns? Well, that's kind of what I was thinking when I read the article. Well, it turns out that the paper reports that in the U.S., the dairy cattle industry goes through a process called disbudding. That's the destruction of the cells that produce horns before they grow and attach to the skull. And it's a routine practice. And they do it for a bunch of reasons. For example, hornless cattle cause less injury to other animals, they require less feeding trough space, they're easier to handle and transport, and they're less aggressive. But the removal of the horns is unpleasant for the cattle, and there have been a lot of groups like PETA that have sought alternatives, more humane solutions, including genetic engineering. One unexpected result that Von Einenum found was that a fragment of bacterial DNA used to deliver the hornless trait to the bull had integrated alongside one of the two hornless alleles in the bull. Von Einenum said, quote, "Our study found that two calves inherited the naturally occurring hornless allele, and four calves additionally inherited a fragment of bacterial DNA known as a plasmid," unquote. That's not really a problem or an issue. I mean, foreign DNA integration can be addressed by screening and selection. In this particular case, all they need to do is just cross the hornless offspring of the genome-edited hornless bull that inherited the naturally occurring allele that didn't have any extra DNA. If they just stick with them, then it's not even an issue at all. And they can continue to cross those, and they'll have a line of bulls that don't have extra foreign DNA, and they will be hornless. Von Einenum's group did not observe any other unintended genomic alterations in the calves, and all animals remained healthy during the entire study period of 3 years. And neither the bull nor the calves entered the food supply, as per FDA guidance for genome-edited livestock. So you can stop worrying about so-called Frankenfood getting into the food supply, at least as far as these cows are concerned. Next story of the evening. Balloons in space! An article last week in the journal Nature from Dr. Ian Haywood's lab at Oxford stated that his team had discovered one of the largest features ever observed in the center of the Milky Way, a pair of enormous radio-emitting bubbles that tower hundreds of light-years above and below the central region of our galaxy. This hourglass-like feature that dwarfs all other radio structures in the galactic center is likely the result of a huge, gigantic, energetic burst that erupted near the Milky Way's supermassive black hole a few million years back. Haywood says, quote, "The center of our galaxy is relatively calm when compared to other galaxies with very active central black holes. Even so, the Milky Way's central black hole can, from time to time, become uncharacteristically active, flaring up as it periodically devours massive clumps of dust and gas. It's possible that one such feeding frenzy triggered powerful outbursts that inflated this previously unseen feature," unquote. Using the South African Meerkat radio telescope, Haywood and his colleagues mapped out broad regions in the center of the galaxy while conducting observations at wavelengths near 23 centimeters. Radio emission of that kind is generated in a process known as synchrotron radiation, where electrons moving at close to the speed of light interact with powerful magnetic fields and create radio waves. It produces a characteristic radio signal that can be used to trace energetic regions in space. Those radio signals easily penetrate the dense clouds of dust that block visible light from the center of the galaxy. By examining the nearly identical size and shape of the twin bubbles, Haywood thinks that his group has found convincing evidence that these features were formed from a violent eruption that occurred over a short period of time and punched through the interstellar medium in opposite directions. Haywood comments that, quote, "This eruption was possibly triggered by vast amounts of stellar gas falling into the black hole, or a massive burst of star formation that sent shockwaves careening through the galactic center. In effect, this inflated bubble in the hot ionized gas near the galactic center energized it and generated radio waves that we could eventually detect here on Earth," unquote. The environment surrounding the black hole at the center of our galaxy is pretty different than the environment anywhere else in the Milky Way, and it still is a region of lots of mystery. Among those mysteries are very long, narrow filaments that aren't found anywhere else in the galaxy. The origin of those has remained an unsolved puzzle since their discovery 35 years ago. The filaments appear as radio structures tens of light years long and approximately a light year wide. Haywood finishes with, quote, "These enormous bubbles have until now been hidden by the glare of extremely bright radio emission from the center of the galaxy. Teasing out the bubbles from the background noise was a technical tour de force, only made possible by Meerkat's unique characteristics and ideal location. With this unexpected discovery, we're witnessing in the Milky Way a novel manifestation of galaxy-scale outflows of matter and energy, ultimately governed by the central black hole," unquote. Next up,
your new brain cell order is up.
It may never occur to you, but at this point in time, in science, we can successfully transplant just about any tissue from one body to another, except neural tissue. If you need a replacement of brain tissue for the damaged stuff, then you're pretty much out of luck. Well, that is until now. Dr. Piotr Waltzak and his team at Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine have demonstrated a new approach for transplanting brain cells. Their method exploits the immune system of the transplant receiver to ensure that the cells are not rejected, and without the need for immune-suppressing drugs. The work was published in the October issue of the journal Brain. The problem with any transplant is the immune system. Neural tissue transplants are no different. The body's response to foreign tissue is a major hurdle to overcome when transplanting cells there as well. Immune-suppressing drugs dampen the immune response as a whole, but they leave the patients open to the risk of infection. Another drawback of these drugs is that the patients will need to pretty much take them for the rest of their lives. To overcome the immune response, Waltzak's team sought to manipulate T cells in the immune system to stop them from recognizing the foreign cells at all and initiating the immune response. And they utilized two antibodies that regulate T cells to do this. The team transplanted glial-restricted progenitor cells, called GRPs, into mouse brains that had been genetically engineered to lack glial cells. These GRPs arise from neuronal stem cells and are a protective brain cell that can migrate and myelinate previously unmyelinated cells. The GRPs were tagged with green fluorescent protein in order to image the transplanted cells. After transplantation, the experimental mice received the antibody to control the T cells for 6 days. In the control group, the mice did not receive the antibody treatment. And the result was that there was no trace of the green fluorescent protein after 21 days, indicating that the GRPs did not survive in the control mice. In the mice who received the antibody treatment, there was a detectable glow for more than 203 days, demonstrating that even after the treatment was stopped, the GRPs were not destroyed by the immune system. Next, the team figured out whether the GRPs were able to carry out their normal function and restore myelination. Using MRI, they assessed structural differences between mouse brains that had normal glial function and those that didn't. They found myelin in the brains of the mice who had received the GRP transplant and the antibody treatment, confirming that the transplanted cells were able to function normally. I know, you're thinking, but Doc, when am I going to need new brain cells? And when is it likely that I'm ever going to lose my GRP cells and lose my myelin? Well, you may not lose your myelin, but there are genetic diseases in which kids are born without proper myelin production. Myelin is absolutely essential for proper signals to be sent quickly down the length of long neurons. It acts as a kind of insulator to speed the signals along. There is one myelin disorder called Pazelius-Merzbacher syndrome, and it affects approximately 1 in every 100,000 children born in the U.S. The condition is life-altering, and it affects the children's motor skills, resulting in them missing developmental milestones. It also causes involuntary muscle spasms and sometimes paralysis of the extremities. This is one of those diseases that I talk about in my medical genetics class, and it does fall into the rather nasty category. Walczak says, quote, "Because conditions like Pazelius-Merzbacher syndrome are initiated by a mutation causing dysfunction in one type of cell, which involves transplanting healthy cells or cells engineered to not have a condition to take over for the diseased, damaged, or missing cells," unquote. Walczak points out that all their findings are preliminary and that they focus solely on localized regions of the brain. In the future, his team aims to combine their discovery with cell delivery methods to attempt more global repairs of brain tissues. Up next, getting fat? Maybe you should sleep more. A new paper from the Journal of Lipid Research suggests that one reason that the Western world has trouble losing weight is that we don't sleep enough anymore. Okay, I'll go along with that one. I've slept pretty terribly since my children were born, and hey, look, I've gained 35 pounds in 13 years. I think I see a correlation here. Getting more serious. As we know, a bad night's sleep will usually lower our mood as well as our energy levels the next day. However, chronic sleep deprivation can have much more harmful effects, including an increased risk of cardiometabolic disease. And I've actually talked about this in previous podcasts. You do risk a heart attack if you continue to get lack of sleep over the long term. And it can go even farther than that. Previous research has demonstrated how long-term sleep deprivation increases your risk of developing obesity and diabetes. However, the majority of these studies have focused pretty much only on glucose metabolism. Now, Dr. Orifu Buxton and company at Penn State University have actually demonstrated how sleep deprivation alters participants' lipid metabolism and how these changes could contribute to increased health risks. The study investigated the effect of restricting sleep on 15 young, healthy male participants to less than 5 hours a night for 4 consecutive nights following a high-fat dinner. No, I don't know why they didn't include women in the study. It seemed to be a pilot study from what I can tell, and I suspect that future studies will probably have people of various ages and genders across the board. This was their first study in this type, so let's give them a break here. So the results. Sleep deprivation decreased the majority of participant-reported experiences of fullness and or satisfaction after finishing their standardized high-fat meal. Blood samples were then taken from all participants, and comparisons showed that sleep deprivation resulted in decreased postprandial lipid levels in the blood. Buxton explained, quote, "The lipids weren't just evaporating. They were being stored away in the body, that is, becoming stored fat," unquote. In order to test the impact of one night of recovery, the participants were allowed 10 hours of sleep before the researchers ran the same tests again. They discovered that although there was improvement in postprandial lipemia, the participants did not recover fully. Even though Buxton's study is limited in scope, it still gives a fascinating insight into how dangerous sleep deprivation can be. And according to the results, when we get less sleep, we get hungrier faster, so we eat more, and then our body stores more fat. It's a vicious cycle. Buxton concludes with, quote, "This study's importance relies on its translational relevance. We are looking at the results of a high-fat meal in the evening at dinner time. And this is real food, not fat literally infused into a vein in your arm. This is typical exposure that we're examining. That's very American. Americans are used to massive doses of dietary fat," unquote. Wow, that is some pot shot, Buxton. Yeah, the observation is valid. It's not very kind, but yeah, it's valid. All right, last story of the night, one of my favorite topics, tardigrades, better known as water bears. Yes, I have another story on those incredibly tiny, incredibly tough, and incredibly cute, multi-legged, little bear-like buggers. Turns out that tardigrades may partly owe their ability to survive in outer space to having the molecular equivalent of cotton candy in their cells. As I talked about a couple of years ago, my August 2017 update, water bears can survive just about anything. They can be heated, they can be cooled, they can be bombarded with X-rays, they can be bombarded with cosmic rays, they can be doused in hydrogen peroxide. Now, the radiation and the chemical exposure of those types usually result in the production of protein DNA damaging hydroxy radicals. These are nasty, highly ionized molecules composed of oxygen and hydrogen. They have the ability to bind onto protein and DNA and really destroy the molecules and break them up into bits. Previous research indicated that a protein called DSUP, for damage suppressor, shields the tardigrade species from radiation. When added to human cells, the protein also protects against radiation. Now, this has only been done in tissue culture, but I mentioned this a couple of years ago, and it's a really interesting breakthrough. Well, now Dr. James Kodonaga of University of California, San Diego, reports in the journal eLife on October 1st that it turns out that the protein DSUP surrounds nucleosomes, and this is how it has its protective ability. So, what are nucleosomes? Well, nucleosomes are a combination of DNA that's wrapped around nuclear proteins called histones. This only occurs in eukaryotic cells, and tardigrades, weird as they are, do have cells like we do. So, this process of wrapping the DNA around histones is designed to help compact eukaryotic DNA, again, like our own or the tardigrades, and it functions in this compaction to allow DNA to be moved around more easily, especially during the process of replication, mitosis and meiosis. So, Kodonaga says that the DSUP protein surrounds the DNA, quote, like a fluffy cloud of cotton candy, unquote, and that the DSUP cloud keeps nasty, damaging hydroxy radicals away from DNA. More specifically, he says, quote, the proteins probably evolved to protect tardigrades from highly reactive hydroxy radicals when they dry out, which is a frequent occurrence. Drying increases the concentration of DNA damaging radicals in cells, and damage can't be repaired while the animals are dormant in their desiccated state. Since X-rays also form hydroxy radicals, tardigrades also happen to be resistant to X-rays as well, unquote. Humans have a similar protein called nucleosome binding proteins, or HMGNs, but the researchers don't know yet whether the human proteins also form a similar shield against DNA-damaging chemicals. I suspect that it's unlikely, since we accumulate DNA damage so much faster than the tardigrades ever do over our lifetimes. In fact, some people have proposed that one reason that humans age, or one reason that any animal ages, is that over time, this damage from the radicals actually builds up and gets greater and greater and greater. Well, here's a modest proposal that probably falls into the category of mad science, but is probably one of the most practical ideas that will be suggested over the next century. Right now, long-distance space travel, even to Mars, which isn't that far, is a serious engineering issue because of radiation in space and because of the long distances involved in that kind of travel. Seems to me that between the DSUP protein and the proteins that protect against icy freezing and tardigrades, we now have all the tools we need to edit the human genetic line and make us ready for long-term space travel. If we implant those proteins into a human, their DNA will be X-ray and cosmic ray resistant, just like the tardigrades, and we'll be able to put a human into a frozen hypersleep for long-distance travel that was impossible previously because it would kill them upon forming ice crystals. Ice crystals pierce and destroy cells. Water freezes to a glass-like consistency in tardigrades because of their cryoprotective proteins, and they can survive multiple freeze-thaws. Human tissues can't even survive one freeze-thaw. Good idea? Bad idea? Scary idea? Remember our friend Dr. He in China? This is the kind of thing he is probably now doing under his house arrest there. And we will see just how many years before our society decides to go in that direction. You want to read a scary book about editing the human genome that was written in 1930, believe it or not? There's a book called Gladiator by Philip Wiley, W-Y-L-I-E. It's been suggested that the main character was one of the templates for Superman a few years later. Improving the physical and endurance skills of humans has been in the minds of scientists for decades, if not centuries. Just something to think about. Well, that's all for me for now. Don't put electrodes in your head. Get a good night's sleep. Make like a tardigrade and get out of here. Keep watching the skies, and I hope I've inspired some of you. Until next time, this is Jim Campanella.